Welcome back to Word on the Hills with me, Felicity Sidnell-Reed, my co-host, Gwyn Sheltimer, and our guest this week, playwright Bernie Morin. So, Bernie, you said that your two friends read your script and your short stories, rather, and said, hey, this needs to be a play or a movie script. So why do you think they were so convinced of that? Isn't it different when it's a radio play? It's as though they were saying, turn it into something visual, and you turn it into something that you have to listen to. What do you think?
It is visual. They are both in theater arts. And so I had to listen to what they were saying. It was like they weren't just saying it to be kind to me. They were encouraging me. Mm. And I thought, well, can I even do this? I mean, do I have the chops to be able to pull this off? And I thought, well, I worked in theater as a 16-year-old. I've always been fascinated by plays. But what about the structure, you know? Mm-hmm. And I had always seen it as a movie. It was that visual in my mind. But I thought, really, a play forces you to create the structure that advances the story. Mm-hmm. And you have to fictionalize parts of it because you don't have the option of moving outside and inside, and you have a certain bit of it, but not a lot. And the house itself is a character in this play. So to me, the set, it has to be fairly static, you know. I wrote it over this long period of time as a play and figured, okay, translating that to cinema, if ever that comes up, would be easy. And then last December, Dave Clark said, would you consider making that a radio play, adapting it? And I thought, oh, can I go back into this? I don't know. It's been 6 years. And I thought, well, I'll give it a crack. And I was shocked at how simple that became. You take lots mm-hmm. out. You know, you can't, if it's radio, there's lots you cannot do. A lot of the sight gags are gone. A lot of the characterization in terms of wardrobe are not available to you. Little things that might happen in the background that supplement the action in the foreground can't happen. But the story stood. Mm-hmm. You know, so I sent it mm-hmm. to Dave and said, what do you think of this? And here we are.
Well, that turned out well. And he produced it for you, didn't he? We should just say that you're referring to Dave Clark, who's the artistic director of Northumberland Players.
And a contributor here at 89.7.
Right. It's interesting that since he does have Northumberland Players at home, he saw that it would be a good radio play rather than putting it on in that theatre. Mind you, it's not a very big theatre. Maybe a play would have required more space.
Well, to Dave's credit, we had each dramaturged each other's work. Mm. And because I had readings with actors and one public reading, I asked him if he would dramaturge it because I really thrive on the criticism. And he said, okay, well, how about if you read the one that I've written, which was to Shut the Mouth of Lions.
Oh, yeah.
So we did that for each other, and it was on the basis of that he suggested maybe it could be adapted.
Mm-hmm. So you did a lot of work on the adaptation. Was it difficult to know what to eliminate from the original? Mm-hmm. What to expand and how to fictionalize and what to fictionalize.
Yeah, and Felicity, the tough thing is when you become in love with your own words certain areas, you know, or certain little, in French we say truc, little things that happen that you really don't want to get rid of, but you right. have to. And even on radio, you're more on the clock than you are with theater. So, yeah, you have to become fairly brutal about it. He had offered to produce it. He said, if you direct it, I'll produce it. And the producing end is something I don't particularly know. I know the talent pool, but he really does know the talent pool. I thought, okay, well, that's the tough part. Well, no, it wasn't. Directing turned out to be the tough part because that includes editing. And
yes.
The editing is endless. And when it's a large cast of people, and so, you know, you're dealing with schedules with volunteers, which usually means evenings. Mm. Over a period of time. So you don't have the luxury of rehearsing that number of people over a long period of time. So it fell to editing to take the best take of this, the best take of that, and marry it together. So it became a patchwork quilt. Yes, very
and
much.
And you told me that You had 17 characterizers.
There's 17 characters. 17 yeah. Characters. There are actually, I designed the play so that 8 people could play the roles, doubling up, because the play is in 2 time periods. Uh-huh. One is in 88. But we go back to 1911 to find out what the source of the original story was.
Uh-huh.
So I had to figure out, as you do, that, okay, this could be played by that person. When are they off stage? Can they do a scene change? Can they change costumes? Can they reappear in here?
Mm-hmm.
And because it was a ghost story, I had them crossing. In other words, I had, if the ghost from 1911 can appear in 1988, then people from 1988 appear in 1911 in the vision of the ghost, because she's existing in 2 worlds at the same time.
But in a radio play, you only have the voices. So that must have been quite a challenge for people who were doubling up too, because did you find that people found it difficult to change their voice into a different character?
There are only one or two people in the radio play. We used more people in the radio play because we had the luxury. We had a casting session and 50 people turned up.
Oh, great.
It was extraordinary. And we'd encourage people who had no acting experience to turn up, because you're dependent on voices that sound different from each other. So you couldn't actually double the characters up, because you weren't changing their costumes at all.
Right.
You're asking them to change a lot. So Stephanie Carabin handled a couple of roles for me, and a couple of other people doubled.
Mm.
But for the most part, we had different people for each one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what were the challenges you faced in writing it, in setting about the writing of it? Was it a case of listening for voices in your own head? And did you hear the words or visualize the scenes?
Well, because I had lived the 1988 portion, the words were pretty well there. And mm-hmm. I had to create a couple of characters who were composites or foils for an existing character, so that there was some dynamic tension within each scene. In 1911, I can't tell you where it came from, but once I had her voice, I understood how she would talk. And I got her father's voice, and I could hear who he was and how he spoke. There's a famous Canadian prime minister in it, which was true. I had no trouble finding words for him and all the supplementary characters. So they were all in my head somewhere, Felicity, and they all found a way onto the page.
Well, could I ask you a question? You said there were 3 spirits that were identified in the house. Were they related?
No. One spirit was the woman for whom the house was built.
Uh-huh.
Second one was this Canadian prime minister. And the third was a young girl. She's not mentioned in the play at all.
Okay, Bernie. Well, can you read us something else from your play?
Certainly. This is from 1911. And the prime voices are the father of the woman around whom this was created. Her name is Amelia. Father's name is Grant, and the young man who, as a surprise house guest and ends up staying there, has flirted with her quite heavily, which is a little bit verboten in 1911, and he's certainly going between financial status when he's doing that, but she's a widow, and he recognizes her vulnerability, so his name is Carter. Amelia and her father have a very confrontational relationship, a lot of anger. And he's about to say goodnight, and he starts by saying, "Good night to you, Mr. Carter." Mr. Carter says, "Good evening, sir." Grant, "Good night, Amelia." No sound. And she says, end narration, "I refused to acknowledge my father's bidding. I was flushed with rage and a history that lay unspoken between us. As I turned to face Mr. Carter, he most suddenly pulled me into a fervent and delicious embrace. I melted like fine chocolate in his arms. How I longed for the warmth of Albert's tenderness." Albert is her late husband. What happened next amidst the clatter and din of the storm that was raging outside remains somewhat murky to me still. I beckoned to Mr. Carter to join me in my room. brazen of me, I blush to admit, yet I felt so drawn to him. He was magnetic and quite unbowed by Father's pontifications. As we ascended the stairs, he had been close behind me, holding my hand ever so tenderly. But when we reached the door of my room, his hand was wrenched from mine as he appeared to fall away. I turned at my door to see that Father had yanked him back like an unruly horse and was proceeding to punch poor Mr. Carter, who was bent backwards over the balcony railing. I dared not look and found myself muffling screams lest our guests would hear. Surely this was a dream. Yet when I looked back, the lights had gone out, due no doubt to the storm, but much to my absolute horror, in the blue glow of lightning, I swear I witnessed dear Mr. Carter falling over the railing, landing with a deafening thud on the floor below. I could not breathe. I could hear my pulse coursing wildly in my ears. Father was aghast and took to his room in haste. Surely this was not true. I could no longer resist a scream and ran down the corridor towards the stairs. Just as I started down the landing, I caught a glimpse of Connor and Gwyneth dragging poor Mr. Carter out the front door by his boots. To my horror, he seemed quite lifeless. The paralysis of emotion spread through my entire body. How could this be happening? What would become of us? The crime had been witnessed. I was terrified and took to my room. There was no sign of Father. How could he act so callously? My hatred of him grew large. My mind swirled with an eddy of disconnected thoughts and rampant outrage. Where were they taking Mr. Carter? Perhaps he was still alive. I dreaded the truth, yet I found myself running back down the hall in utter panic and confusion and stood at the top of the stairs. Mr. Carter? Mr. Carter, are you all right? Randolph? Father? What has happened, Father? Randolph? Mr. Carter? Albert? Are you there? Is that you?
Thank you so much. That was really something to get people to listen to it. Remind us how our listeners can listen to In Continuum.
You can hear In Continuum by going to the website, hitting the menu on the right upper right-hand side, and podcasts, and you'll see In Continuum, and it's there in its 5 chapters.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. We hope you'll join us for another program next week on this station, Northumberland 89.7, Truly Local Radio.